This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this very exciting session, Climate Change Beyond the City Limits. Now, I'm your chair for this morning. My name's Carol Vincent, and I'm the Chief Executive of the South Australian Farmers Federation. Before we begin, I'm just going to do a little bit of an audience survey to see who we've got with us today. Can you put your hand up for me if you're from interstate or overseas, please? Excellent. Do we have any farmers in the audience? Oh, well done. Round of applause for our farmers. Metropolitan Adelaide people. Academics. Politicians. Oh, well, then I need to say that you just need to recognise there's no parliamentary privilege this morning. Now, I would ask you all to turn your mobile phones off. I know in some of the other sessions they've been ringing in the middle of people's presentations. Very frustrating and very rude. We've got a wonderful panel for you this morning. I've just been having a quick chat with them in the green room, and they've certainly got me thinking ahead. Now, climate change beyond the city limits, what does this mean in South Australia? What does this mean for regional and rural South Australia? I'll pose some questions to you. There are some things that we do know. We do know that we will have less frost. We do know that the temperatures will rise. Two God-given facts. The farmers that I work with are saying, We want to know what climate change means. If we need to adapt and mitigate, we want to know what to do now. The thing is, nobody can tell them what they're going to need to do for the future. So hopefully, we might get some kind of headway down that path. So here are some questions. Will South Australia's water be totally supplied by Salisbury Council and Colin Pittman? And only the people from South Australia will know the meaning of that. Will we have operational pastoral lands? Will South Australia just become, outside the city limits, a huge mining area dust bowl? We've had the state government release its 30-year strategy for Greater Adelaide this week. They say in that strategy that over the next 30 years we're going to have 139,000 people living in the Barossa Valley. Can you imagine that? How do we deal with climate change and population growth of that degree? I'm not going to talk anymore because it's the panel that you want to hear from, and what a wonderful panel they are. We're going to begin with Suzanne Miller. And Suzanne moved with her family to South Australia in 2007. And I've got to say that from where I sit, Suzanne, South Australia has certainly embraced you. I think everybody was a bit tired of Tim Flannery. He's one of those people that you love to love from a distance, but, you know, if you're too close up, you can have enough. So Suzanne has taken on the appointment as director of the South Australian Museum. She grew up in Edinburgh, Scotland. She studied geology honours at the University of St Andrews before completing her PhD in marine geology at Imperial College, University of London. She has since spent 12 years with the National Museum Scotland as Principal Curator of Geology and then Keeper of Natural Sciences. As lecturer in Earth Sciences with the University of Aberdeen and the Open University, as a researcher in BBC Science Communications, as a postdoctoral research associate in environmental chemistry, Universities of Lancaster and Oxford, as a petroleum geochemist, Institute of Offshore Engineering, Orkney. Where's Orkney?
North of Scotland.
Okay. North of Scotland. And as a metamorphic petrologist, British Antarctic Survey. You know, this is amazing for me. I never finished school, so being amongst all these academics is just, you know, blowing me away. In her role in Adelaide, she is also affiliate professor in Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Adelaide and is deputy chair of the Premier's Climate Change Council. She holds a yacht master's coastal skipper licence, radio operator's licence and powerboat licence, in addition to being a qualified advanced diver. So if there's a flood today, she's going to be able to get us out of here. It's with great pleasure that I introduce our first speaker, Suzanne Miller.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I have to say it's also wonderful to be the first speaker up. If you come second or third, you have to adapt what you're planning to change to what's gone before. So it's a great privilege to be up first. So apologies to my other panelists. As a geologist, I'm very aware that climate change happens. It's a fact of life, and it has been a fact of life ever since life evolved on this planet. Billions of years of climate change has happened and will continue to happen. The planet is a constantly evolving, changing beast. It is a very holistic place. The atmosphere interacts with the hydrosphere and interacts with the geosphere. So climate change happens. At the moment, climate change is happening on quite a rapid pace. But I would like just to say, as a geologist, that there's a lot of information out there about climate change and the fact that, well, it's always happened. Why are we so worried right now about what we're doing as human beings to the climate? And I think that we have to be very careful about comparing very different scales of evidence. There is a geological scales of evidence where 1 millimeter of rock or 1 centimeter of rock can equate to 100,000 years or 100 million years. And now we are able to look, because we have the science and we have the technology to be able to work out what the climate is doing on much smaller scales, we have much more detailed evidence of what's happening in our lifetime. Climate change is happening. We can see that the evidence is now fitting the models that were developed some time ago, and it is a fact of life, and it's affecting our everyday lives. I think in terms of the topic today, beyond the city limits, there is a lot to lose outside of the city limits associated with climate change, but there is also potentially a lot to gain. And I think that's why this particular topic is of particular interest. It gives a particular difference to the usual debate on climate change. What I thought was I'd just give a brief rundown of my understanding of the carbon pollution reduction scheme, just to set some boundaries. It sort of outlines the emissions trading scheme for Australia. Now, by that, it basically commits Australia to medium-term national targets to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by between 5% and 15% of 2000 levels by 2020. Now, the upper limit equates to a sort of per capita drop of about 41% over that period of time. The long-term target, 60% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, but it's actually the interim targets that really matter. They are ambitious, but they're deeply challenging goals, and I think that they are equal or better to than the per capita targets proposed by other developed nations, such as in the EU, the UK, and the US. But the Australia's 2050 target is unmoved from previous policy, but as I said, I think it's the short-term targets that actually really matter. It's also about how we view the globe as a holistic being, as a holistic environment where all of the different environments interact with each other. And that's where I think there are some problems with the way that the politicians are viewing the Earth's environment. I would also like to say that I think that the scientific evidence, I'm not a climate change scientist, but I have looked very carefully at all of the evidence, and the evidence does seem to be coming across that for a safer global and Australian climate, we really ought to be looking at reductions of at least 20% by 2020. So the current targets fall a long way short of that. Now, there are two reasons why Australia needs to have targets. We need to do our part in reducing global emissions, bearing in mind that we do emit more per head of population than almost any other country. But more importantly, we also need to show how serious we are to be able to put pressure on other countries, including the US, to act as well. Developing countries may well not act if we don't, but we also need to be very aware of the sort of global equity that is required in this equation. There's been a lot of recent debate as well about the relative merits of a simple carbon tax versus a more complex cap and trade system that's represented by the CPRS. Now, I will use CPRS simply because carbon pollution reduction scheme is a bit of a mouthful. But it seems to me that a fossil fuel tax at the oil and gas wellhead or the coal mine gate, with dividends returned in full to the public, would be much simpler. Although there's nothing inherently wrong with a cap and trade scheme, although I think that you have to take in mind a much broader holistic view of what that means. The two most obvious problems to me with the CPRS version of the cap and trade that's been presented in legislation here. Is that the proposed cap is far too weak, and free permits apparently seem to be being handed out to some of the heavy polluters. Of course, the other major issue is that the legislation doesn't include any measures to reduce emissions from major non-energy sectors such as agriculture and land clearing. And yet those areas are inherently important to the whole system. But of course, they're not quantitative. It's extremely difficult to work out how those systems interact. And indeed, should we even be trying to work out how those systems interact? They are very different natural systems to the industrial systems. And it seems to me to be a very unnatural merging of the two to try and bring them all into one single scheme. Australia has one of the highest per capita emission rates in the industrial world, as I've said, and as a carbon-intensive economy, it should actually be easier for us, in a way, to reduce our carbon emissions. If I can use an analogy, if someone is very obese, it's relatively easier for them to lose 5 kilograms in weight than it is for somebody who starts out underweight. But we can't forget the other half of the equation. Australia's per capita emission levels are about double that of Europe and 4 times the world average. That means Australia's fair share is to cut faster than others and in greater terms. However, I have to say that the per capita targets in the scheme are based on a 45% increase in Australia's population between 1990 and 2020, which is clearly not a fair game in terms of the global market. Our targets need to be calculated on a base level of population growth, not what we aspire to. Otherwise, countries like China, who are limiting their population growth, are actually going to be, they're not going to benefit from that. And I don't think that that's an acceptable international position. Thank you very much. And it could indeed severely block any international agreement. I think we are right to focus on a per capita emission, but it's only in an equitable manner, so that developing countries who will inevitably increase their carbon emissions are not in any way blocked from being able to participate in a global reduction system. I think that in order for us in Australia to achieve some of our cuts, we will need to have a revolution. We will need to have a revolution in the way that we generate and conserve energy. In a mere 12 years, we've only have 12 years in which to do this, we will have to turn around decades of rampant growth in carbon emissions and energy supply from fossil fuel industries. And whether the CPRS plan is sufficiently revolutionary and robust, I really am not sure that it is. I think it's a matter that's been currently very widely debated. Of course, Australia has much more renewable energy potential than almost any other country, especially solar energy and geothermal energy, wind and tidal power, and it's time that we really cashed in on that opportunity. We also have an extraordinary rural community, people who really understand working on the edge of environmental limits. I think more than any other agricultural community, for example, in, say, Europe or North America, I think the Australian agricultural community really understands adaptation. I've had the great honour and privilege to be able to travel throughout rural Australia throughout the last 2 years, particularly in South Australia. And farmers know what they are doing. They can see the changes that are happening, and they have an extraordinary capacity to adapt to those changing conditions. I think that one of the major failings that I can see from something like the CPRS is that perhaps the government is not paying enough attention to the wealth of knowledge that is currently in Australia around land use and trying to integrate that into some kind of policy or have an equivalent policy that's running alongside the more industrial-based policies. I think it is going to need a truly revolutionary set of policies and very strong political will to rapidly wean ourselves off a carbon-based energy. Yet from a fossil fuel supply, the peak oil, gas and coal, and a climate perspective, that is exactly what we must do. From an agricultural perspective, from a water perspective, that is exactly what we must do. Even to achieve the cuts announced by the government, we must implement really radical improvements in our energy efficiency and develop agricultural policies that allow us to have an entirely new infrastructure in the way that we use the land and the way that we interact with the land. So one has to ask the question, I think, why not commit to going all the way and actually solving the crisis before it has time to happen, rather than merely half solve it in such a way that we can best do is to inevitably delay the crunch. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Suzanne. And that was certainly a vote of confidence in South Australian and Australian farmers. So the farmers in the audience, please take note of that. The gentleman that I'm going to introduce next is quite fascinating in that he has worked with two of the more interesting politicians that we have in this country. And I'll tell you more about that in a second. It's sort of fascinating, isn't it? Especially federally. We seem on both sides of the political fence to have leaders who aren't particularly charismatic, but they're into that kind of bland sort of talk show host kind of thing. But he's worked with more of the two interesting ones. His name is Richard Dennis. He's Dr. Richard Dennis, and he's the Executive Director of the Australia Institute, a public policy think tank based in the national capital of Canberra. An economist by training, Richard's research centres on the design of market regulation, particularly in the areas of the labour market and the environment. He has published a number of articles and monographs, I don't know if I know what that is, on new measures of national wellbeing based around the construction of the genuine progress indicator for Australia. Prior to his current position, Richard worked as strategy advisor to Senator Bob Brown, one of our more interesting politicians, leader of the Australian Greens, and he was also chief of staff to the then leader of the Australian Democrats, Senator Natasha Stott Despoja, and has lectured in economics at the University of Newcastle. He is an adjunct professor at the Crawford School of Economics and Government, Australian National University, has published widely in academic journals and newspapers, and is the co-author of Affluenza, When Too Much Is Never Enough, and Australian Policy, Theory and Practice. Please welcome the man with two Christian names, Richard Dennis, to the floor.
Thank you very much for the lengthy introduction. In case anyone left anything off my CV, I'm sorry whoever provided you with all that. But thanks for having me today. And what an important topic, and how important to see, how many people willing to come out and think and talk about climate change on a Sunday morning. Look, let me just take off from where the last speaker left off. I couldn't agree more that climate change and climate change policy is going to be central to how this century unfolds. And I have very deep concerns that the current proposals to tackle climate change are fundamentally inadequate. Fundamentally inadequate, I'm choosing my words carefully, to address the problem. And the problem is that this problem, the problem of climate change, is quite unlike most of the problems we're familiar with. Most problems that we deal with, especially in federal parliament, compromise and negotiation and middle roads and taking people with you and all these sorts of approaches often work. You want to have an argument about, you know, the minimum wage. You want to have an argument about tax rates. You want to have an argument about private and public health provision. Well, the answer you'll usually find is in getting the balance right. It's, you know, somewhere in the middle. Both, everyone was a little bit right and we all had to settle for something. Well, the problem is, no matter how persuasive Kevin Rudd thinks he is, you can't negotiate with the atmosphere. Right? It's just... There's no negotiation taking place. There is just cause and effect. And what I find infuriating is that while, yes, this government has taken a big step compared to the last government in admitting that we have a problem, now it's a bit weird that that would be a big step, but it's a big step. But how? This is the infuriating bit. How can you listen to the scientists who've diagnosed the problem and then ignore those same scientists when developing a solution? You can't negotiate with the science. You can't negotiate with the atmosphere. And to use a simple analogy, if you were to go to the doctor and the doctor were to diagnose an illness and prescribe a course of treatment, and that course of treatment was expensive and distasteful, but they said, if you take this course of treatment, there's a 80% chance that you will make it. There aren't many people I know would leave, ring their accountant, discuss the price of the pills, and while still agreeing with the diagnosis, decide to take 5% of the prescription. I'm trying to be angry, and it's hard when you clap and you laugh. I mean, this is serious stuff. So climate change is about risk. There is no certainty. Get over it. If you want certainty, forget it. You're in the wrong space. We don't know what's going to happen. But we've got a pretty good idea what might happen if we keep doing what we're doing. And we're not entirely certain, frankly, that we can avoid it, even if we give it a red-hot go. But what we're certain of, at least scientifically certain of, is if we don't give it a red-hot go, we're stuffed. And 5% or 25%, regardless of whether that's better than what the Americans are proposing, again, the atmosphere doesn't care. And if you believe the science about the problem, you must believe the science about the solution. So our political processes, I fear, are entirely inadequate for this, because as Kevin Rudd and Penny Wong would go out of their way to explain to you, well, we've listened to the scientists and we've listened to the polluters and we think we got the balance right. It's just no balancing to be had. You either listen to the science or you listen to the polluters. And the whole political strategy of saying, well, if four people tell me I'm wrong, I must be right. Well, if four people tell you you're wrong, you might be an idiot, you know? So this idea that I've upset the environmentalists and I've upset the polluters, so I must be on the right track, is kind of inconsistent with logic. But, hey, someone voted for them. So, what's democracy? You know, everyone in here is smart, but everyone out there is stupid. So climate change is about risk, okay? And how we want to cope with uncertainty. And farming, and I'll talk about farming and the impact outside of the city soon. Farming is about risk and risk management. And there aren't many farmers and there aren't many humans who I know who don't, in order to avoid catastrophic risk, take some precautions, even if those precautions, in the best case scenario, are unnecessary. Now, the easiest example of that is, you know, someone in here might insure their car. I insure my car. And at the end of each year, I do not call myself an idiot because I didn't crash my car. Oh, wasted my money. Waste. $1,200 down the drain, didn't have a crash. Like most people, I spend some money in order to avoid the downside of catastrophe, and then I hope I don't have a catastrophe. Well, I hope we don't have climate change. I hope someone invents carbon capture and storage. I hope Ian Plimer is right. But hope isn't a strategy. So what I do in my personal life is I take precautions when the stakes are high and I take risks when the stakes are low. Parking fines in Adelaide are so cheap, I don't pay for parking. But the catastrophe of a $20 fine for someone that lives in a city where it's $10 an hour to park is not such a problem. But that's not how I make decisions about my car or my family or my life. And that's the point. It's not, are you a risk taker or are you not? It's under the specific circumstances, do I want to take a risk or don't I? And as I said, most farmers that I've spoken to are quite cautious people. You know, they literally don't like to bet the farm. Why don't you bet the farm? Because if you lose, you've got nothing left. Yet when it comes to climate change, we seem willing to bet the farm. Let me talk briefly about carbon capture and storage, which is one way we could bet the farm. There's this fictional technology called carbon capture and storage. It doesn't exist. It's like werewolves. I'll come back to werewolves. At least I don't think they exist. Carbon capture and storage would allow us to take all the carbon that comes out of a giant power station and pump it underground and store it safely. If this worked, we could keep burning enormous amounts of coal. The problem is, no one's invented it yet. Ring Penny Wong's office, ring anyone's office and say, I'd like to go take a photo of a carbon capture and storage plant. Where do I go? You'll find a paddock somewhere where one day someone might build one of these things. No one has invented carbon capture and storage yet. People are working on how to capture it. People are working on how to compress it. People are working on how to bury it. People are working on where to bury it. And for the last 15 years, they've been telling us it's 10 years away. Well, it's still 10 years away. The problem is, as we just heard, we need to reduce emissions by 2020. No one's invented carbon capture and storage yet. Yet, as long as that myth is out there, we can carry on business as usual. We can keep doing what we're doing because, relax, we're going to work on carbon capture and storage. Well, I'm glad we're working on it. Do not get me wrong. But I'm not betting. I don't want to bet my family on them pulling it off because they're not even close. And even if they figure it out, nobody thinks it's going to be cheap. Yet you know the reason that we can't invest in wind and solar today? Oh, it's too dear. Well, the same people that want carbon capture and storage ignore the fact of how expensive it is. Now, just very briefly, so we can get to question and answer, I just want to show you, not tell you, how emissions trading works. Because emissions trading is central to the way that we in Australia want to tackle climate change. And I fear that the government is relying on the fact that no one understands it in order to build support. Now, that's a risk which I hope I'm about to explode. So, can my three victims, who've already agreed, just come and stare awkwardly? Just stand here and stare awkwardly. Who came to my thing on Friday? Apologies. Ooh, quite a few. I haven't got that many jokes. Okay, here's how emissions trading works. It's called a cap and trade scheme because we cap emissions trading. And we're just going to have our own little Adelaide emissions trading scheme here where between us we cap our emissions at 3 tonnes. And each person standing up here is temporarily a permit. So if you want to pollute, you've got to buy a permit. This is exactly how taxi plate licences work. This is exactly how fishing quotas work. You say there's a fixed amount of something that can be done, and then we let you guys figure out who's going to own the right to pollute. How do we figure out who owns a waterfront property? We auction it. Under an emissions trading scheme, how do we figure out who gets the right to pollute? We auction it. Step one, however, is to say, how much pollution do we want to have? Actually, can you all take a step back? Because I'm about to ask someone to take a step forward, and that would be precarious. Okay. So we set emissions at 3 tonnes. We've ignored the scientists, and the scientists said, oh, you probably want 2 tonnes, but we went, oh, we'll get the balance right, we'll go with 3. So we've gone with 3 tonnes, and Brendan, if you can just stand over here. Let's start by saying these 2 permits here are used by you and us when we use our air conditioners and drive our cars and do our household stuff. And Brendan over here is the polluter's permit, the evil permit that we use to make steel and aluminium. But under emissions trading, there's no such thing as evil. There's no better and worse taxi plate license. There's just the taxi license. So some of us in the household sector were concerned by the idea, quite concerned by the idea that we set a target of 3 tonnes when the scientists said, if you have 3 tonnes, you're stuffed. So in order to do our bit, we'll put insulation in our roofs, we'll put insulation in our walls, we'll never use our air conditioner again, and we'll feel guilty all the time. And let's face it, that's what tackling climate change is all about, feeling guilty all the time. So if you can just take a big step in the right direction for me, there you go, the household sector's leading by example. It's doing its bit. We've reduced the household emissions by 50%. Unfortunately, yay, give yourself a pat on the back. Come with me. Because it's emissions trading, what do you think happens to our spare permit? Brendan snaps her up. if he wants to make more steel or aluminium, he can. Because if you don't want a taxi plate license, you sell it. If you don't want to pollute, someone else can. It's the T in emissions trading scheme. This is not a secret. No one denies this. They just know that you don't know it. So don't get me wrong, emissions trading can work. But if you set the target wrong at the beginning, it won't work. Imagine, look what happened with water. We had a water trading scheme. Whoopee! What did we do? We gave away far too many rights for people to take water out. You know what they did? They took water out. All right, if we give away too many permits at the beginning, nothing you do, you as individuals, nothing you can do, nothing the South Australian government can do, can reduce emissions. Because we set a national cap and all we're doing is haggling over who gets to do it. And as Brendan's going to talk about, you know, the only way, the only thing you can do is actually happens outside of your houses, because the uncovered sectors, the agriculture sector, the forestry sector, you can plant trees in your backyard, no one can stop you. But turning your lights off and driving a Prius will just free up permits for someone else. So please thank our permits. Yeah. So on that note, carbon capture and storage is not a silver bullet. Because, you might think it's a silver bullet, but if we put all of our effort into that silver bullet, it's the silver bullet that's going to kill us. It's the risk that we can't take to put all of our eggs in one basket. Similarly, the emissions trading scheme is this policy silver bullet. It says once we introduce emissions trading, that's it. Nothing you do matters anymore. We're stuck with it. Well, the policy silver bullet will kill us as well. Thank you.
Don't you think Richard's the guy that we wish Peter Garrett was?
Men.
You know, agriculture in South Australia contributes $5 billion to the state's economy. Isn't that extraordinary? And even though we've had a number of years of drought, it's still continued to grow. So what does that say about the future for agriculture in this state? Now, our next speaker is just the nicest man. Just having met him briefly and had a discussion with him, he's not only an academic and somebody that has extraordinary knowledge, but he's nice. This always comes as a surprise to me. And the bios are long, though my PA cut them significantly. They were each an hour long. So, but I think it's good to understand who it is that is speaking to you and bringing you these ideas. Brendan Mackey is a professor of environmental science in the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University. Brendan's research, teaching and outreach is focused on understanding the role of the biosphere in Earth's life support systems, especially the climate system and how such understanding can help people and societies reorientate and re-engineer toward more sustainable ways of living. Brendan has a long-standing commitment to international dialogue and research on sustainability. He is a member of the Earth Charter Initiative International Council, a member of the International Union for Conservation of Nature Council, and chairs the Council's Climate Change Task Force. He also works with the Convention on Biological Diversity in preparing scientific reports on the relationships between biodiversity, climate change, and resilience. Locally, he's a member of the Cape York Peninsula Cultural and Scientific Advisory Committee, which provides advice to the Queensland State Government on areas of international conservation significance in the Cape York region. Brendan convenes a graduate course in climate change impacts and adaptation at the Australian National University and also co-convenes the Blue Planet, an introduction to Earth system science. Please welcome Brendan to the lectern.
I'll remember to send shorter bios in future. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for coming here on a Sunday morning. I'm impressed. Could I just have a show of hands who was at my talk yesterday? Okay, well, I'm only going to tell one of my three climate change jokes today, so just laugh politely when you hear it again. In climate change jargon, we talk about mitigation and adaptation. The word mitigation means we're trying to solve the problem, and the word adaptation means that we're now locked into whatever we do, unavoidable climate change, to which we have to adapt, right? So, but obviously the extent to which we have to adapt will depend on our success or failure with mitigation. So, and we've got to do two things when we're looking for mitigation, what are called mitigation measures. These are activities or things we can do. They could be policy measures or actions we can take to solve the problem. And, of course, the mitigation problem is solved when we reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere such that the concentration of gases in the atmosphere stabilises at a level or below a level that avoids what we call dangerous climate change. And the scientific advice is that that equates to about an increase of a planetary average temperature increase of about 2 degrees Celsius. Now, a couple of weeks ago in Canberra, the maximum daily temperature for the day got to 2 degrees Celsius. And it was so the daily range was minus 2 to plus 2. And you tell people 2 degrees temperature increase is, you know, dangerous climate change, and they think you're crazy. But that's because that 2 degrees number, and you'll be hearing it all the time, because the G8 governments have kind of agreed to that kind of target. You know, it's a diagnostic indicator. It's a metric. The problem with talking about averages is, and here's my joke from yesterday, you know, there aren't many climate change jokes, and this is one of them. You know, no one lives in a place called average, right? It's not very funny to begin with. But you know, it's just a diagnostic. It's an indicator. If the planetary temperature on average changes that much, it's an indicator that we're going to have major changes in weather systems at regional and local scales. Anyway, in addition to... So when we have mitigation activities, we have to try and solve the problem faster than what we're creating it, okay? And that's what the previous two speakers have been talking about. You know, it's no good having a measure which doesn't fix the problem faster than we're creating it. So that's the first challenge. The second challenge, right, and this is where it comes back to talking about land, is we have to avoid what in climate change speak is called, we have to avoid perverse outcomes. And I don't mean, you know, I mean perverse has a particular meaning in this context. That, you know, that was another joke, but it didn't, went down really badly, didn't it? Yeah. Which... We avoid in having a measure to mitigate for climate to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. We have to avoid causing bad things to happen somewhere else. Okay, so one of the problems we face at the moment is that people are proposing to mitigate climate change by doing stuff to land that's going to interfere with many of the things we currently value from land. Okay, so for example, people are talking about turning land into charcoal farms. So rather than growing food, we grow charcoal, right? So that's an example of a perverse outcome. Or some people are saying we should clear natural ecosystems and do something else with the land that might take up carbon more quickly. So in thinking about mitigation measures, we have to have measures that solve the problem faster than we're creating it, and avoid perverse outcomes. So let me say something about the land generally. We've actually got two mitigation problems, and this is something we haven't quite got clear in our minds. And it's creating confusion in our policy. There's actually two sources of emissions of greenhouse gases. One is burning fossil fuels for energy, and the other is from land clearance and degradation of natural ecosystems. If you look at the total amount of accumulated greenhouse gases that are in the atmosphere due to human activity, mainly over the last couple of hundred years, 70% of those emissions are from burning fossil fuel and 30% of them are from land clearing and land degradation. Currently, on an annual basis, about 20% of greenhouse emissions are from land clearing. There's about 2.5, and I've got to use some numbers here, there's about 2,500 billion tonnes of carbon stored in terrestrial ecosystems on Earth, and about half of that is in the world's forests, because they're the most carbon-dense systems. That's 2 trillion tonnes of carbon. Okay, there's 780 billion tonnes in the atmosphere. So there's three times more stored in the vegetation and in the soil than what there is in the atmosphere. There's 5 trillion tonnes of fossil fuel left. There's a lot of fossil fuel to burn. So we have two challenges. One is we have to have deep cuts in fossil fuel emissions. And secondly, we have to work out how we can protect and restore the what I call the green carbon that's stored in terrestrial ecosystems. Both of them present unique challenges to us, but they're quite different problems. Humans have lots of uses for land, like we like to eat, we need to eat, and we need to grow food, and we need land for food. So about half of the world's forests have been cleared. Australia's the same. We've cleared about half of our forests. A lot of that was for a good reason. It's to grow food, okay? This is a necessary thing. Globally, we've got a big problem. There's 2,500 billion tonnes of carbon, 2 trillion tonnes of carbon left in the world's forests. If we continue to deforest them at current rates, which is 2% a year, in 50 years' time they'll be gone, and most of that carbon will be in the atmosphere and interacting with the oceans. So it's a big dilemma. You know, human populations are increasing. We need land for settlement. We need land for food. You know, how do we deal with that? You know, it's a very big problem. And over here we've got this other problem of dramatically reducing our use of fossil fuel and the emissions from fossil fuel. The problem is the main policy responses our governments are coming up with are muddling those two problems together. Our government's proposed carbon pollution reduction scheme, have I said that right? God, it's a mouthful, isn't it? It's a shocker. Is going to allow polluters to supposedly offset some of their fossil fuel emissions by planting trees. Now let's think about that. Where can you grow trees? You can grow trees where they naturally grow. Well, if there's room to plant them, it means the land was cleared. But what happened to all the carbon that was stored on that land before it was cleared? Well, it's combusted and it's in the atmosphere. So when you plant trees on previously cleared land, and that's the only place you can plant them, it is important because what you're doing is paying back the carbon debt from when the land was cleared. You're not actually offsetting the fossil fuel emission. So just let me say something. So it's important that we do that, you know, to the extent we can. If it's land where we're growing food and we want to keep growing food, maybe there's some change we can make to the agricultural land practice that will increase the density of soil carbon in a useful way. But, you know, we just have to accept that growing food has a carbon footprint. It can be moderated, but the main carbon footprint from when the land was cleared originally. Okay, so we're there's just some reality we have to keep in mind there. So let's look at a fossil fuel emission. Let's look at what happens to a pulse of carbon dioxide when we burn a ton of coal or a ton of oil or a ton of natural gas. It actually goes on a very long journey. It goes up into the atmosphere, obviously. Then what happens to it? Well, some of it's taken up by trees and in the soil and spends a certain amount of time in these terrestrial ecosystems, be they agricultural or natural forests. And you can think of that as a buffer. It's like a sponge. It's kind of expandable. It can hold a certain amount of carbon. But the carbon doesn't stay there forever. The system leaks carbon as well. It exchanges carbon with the atmosphere. Some of the fossil fuel carbon's taken up into the oceans. Very complex process. But again, it doesn't stay there forever. It's released back into the atmosphere. So the ocean and the terrestrial part of the biosphere you can think of as two big buffers. The pulse of fossil fuel CO2 goes into the atmosphere, stays in the terrestrial buffer for a while, back into the atmosphere, gets taken up by the ocean, back into the atmosphere. Eventually, it works its way down where? To the bottom of the ocean. It actually gets incorporated up into sediment at the bottom of the ocean. It's a natural process. Geologists study this. They know all about this. But it takes a long time. It takes about 300 years to get 75% of that pulse of fossil fuel CO2 to the bottom of the ocean in the sediment. But there's 25% left, and it's a really long tail. And guess how long it takes to get rid of the last 25%? Just guess. Someone yell out a number. Not quite. Sorry? Yeah, 30,000 years. So it's 300 years to fossil fuel emissions are offset when they're incorporated. The only way we can get, the only way the planet gets rid of them is by working through all these subsystems to set them at the bottom of the ocean. It takes 300 years to get rid of three quarters of it, and kind of there's 25% that's continuing to interact with the atmosphere kind of forever. It's not really forever, but as far as humans are concerned, I think we can say forever. So we need policies and measures that enable us to dramatically reduce emissions from using fossil fuel and help us prevent further emissions from the land and restore some of the land's capacity to store carbon. If the carbon's not in the land, then it's in the atmosphere and ocean, and it's interacting with the atmosphere and ocean and causing climate change. So the larger the pool of carbon and the longer it's left in the land, the bigger that buffer is, you know, we are helping the problem. So we need to think about how we can prevent emissions from the land and as much as possible try and increase the density of carbon on land to the extent it's possible. But where you grow food, it's very limited because the main land use is, you know, growing food. So what does this mean? Well, I think in terms of a global cap-and-trade scheme and a national cap-and-trade scheme, right, these should be, if we're going to have them, they should be restricted to trading fossil fuel carbon. And people should not be allowed to offset fossil fuel emissions by planting trees. Okay. However, having said that, we need other policies and incentives to help protect and restore the green carbon that is on the land. Okay, because we need to do that as well. So how do we do that? Well, I think the best concept there is payment for ecosystem services. So you look at all the benefits we get from well-managed, from good natural resource management, either in the rangelands or in our forests or in intensive agricultural zone. We get regulation of fresh water supplies. We get protection of soil fertility and productivity and habitat for wildlife. And there's also a carbon benefit. And all of those kind of come together. It's a bundled set of assets. So, you know, I think we need to be thinking about how we can pay land managers and landowners for, give them payments for this bundled set of ecosystem services, which includes carbon. Because if we take carbon out and treat it as a fundable value, we start to distort what we're doing on the land, and we'll get perverse outcomes. I think the simplest and most economically efficient and powerful way of reducing fossil fuel emissions is to put a tax on carbon. Okay, you would immediately change the price of energy, and a whole bundle of alternative energy sources would immediately become cost-effective, including wind, including solar, and actually also nuclear. Nuclear, this is an interesting one, nuclear power energy would start to become cost-effective in Australia, which currently it isn't. Now, that opens a whole other set of issues. And again, this is why, as our first speaker said, we need to look at the whole system, our whole social and economic and social and biophysical system. We've got to fix the problem faster than we're creating it, and we have to avoid perverse outcomes in the policies and measures we adapt for mitigation. Thank you.
What I like about these three is that they're not just
really knowledgeable and good speakers, but they're a lot of fun too, and they make jokes. I like that. Also, really happy that Brendan supports what the South Australian Farmers Federation calls stewardship payments for our farmers. It's something that we've been lobbying hard with both state and federal governments to introduce. They're the stewards of the land for all of the community, and they should be recognised as such. Now, I'm going to open it up in a second for questions to our panel, and also to get some good discussion happening. Need to let you know that I won't accept long-winded statements that eventually are going to turn into questions in a half an hour's time. Shut you down if you do that. There are some microphones upstairs. There's a microphone over in that corner, and down here there's a microphone somewhere. In the middle of the aisle. They told me the middle aisle, and of course I couldn't figure out where that was. It's just there for those in front, it's behind you. Those at the back, you can see it. Now, are they lining up upstairs? Yes? Okay, when you ask your question, can you just indicate whether it's for one particular member of our panel or you don't mind who it is? If you want to tell us who you are, that's great, but it's not totally necessary. First question from upstairs, please.
My question's for Richard Dennis. I come from Alice Springs, one of the most remote communities in Australia, and along the lines of energy, nuclear has only just been touched on. We have a huge area around Alice Springs being opened up for nuclear exploration, including the Angela Pamela exploration, which is 25 kilometres from our CBD and within our water catchment. As people can imagine, this is a huge impact on our town. What can rural and regional and remote communities do to mitigate the effects of our ability to oppose this in a system which only provides us with very limited representation in federal parliament? And what are the impacts? Is this marginalisation of rural communities part of a system that centralises power and resource allocation in the cities and therefore degrades regional and remote Australian areas?
Richard.
Look, I think the heart of your question is, why is it that the minuscule percentage of our population that owns shares in mining companies has so much more influence over the policy debate than you or I do? Whether it's the expansion of uranium mining or whether it's the fact that in order to stimulate our economy, we're spending more money to expand coal export terminals than we are to invest in renewable energy. No matter where I look, what I see is a disproportionate influence of the people who profit from these activities over the desires of yourself and I think the vast majority of Australians. So, if you want to have a chat afterwards or send me an email, I'll happily give you some campaign advice. I think the main thing is to link up with people who might not live near you but might share your concerns and aim your frustration at the people you're most able to hurt, not the people who are most responsible.
Thank you. Question from the gentleman downstairs.
Yes, I'd like to ask Richard a question as well because he mentioned Ian Plimer. I know that no amount of good science would get Ian Plimer to change his mind about humans causing global climate change, but if you had the chance to speak with him or to him, what would you actually say? Richard, thanks.
Well, look, I loved Ian Plimer's book, Telling Lies for God. I thought he applied his obvious intellect to demolishing something. But unfortunately, neither in Telling Lies for God nor his recent book has he actually advanced something. Like, what, you know, he's an intelligent bloke. What he's done is, put together a whole bunch of criticisms of something, but he hasn't actually put anything up himself. He's not actually saying what he thinks is going on. He's just nitpicking at everything that other people are doing. So, look, I think the question for Ian Plimer is, given, say there was a 5% chance that he's wrong, and being wrong involves catastrophic consequences for mankind, and given that the costs of tackling climate change are, according to the Treasury modelling, minuscule, wouldn't a rational person, including a scientist like himself, think the smart thing to do is to head off a potential problem, and if he wants to gloat in 20 years' time, well, I'll give him a medal.
If I can ask a supplementary question, I think it's about page 20, he talks about mathematical modelling, and for a scientist, I just find it incredible that even though mathematical modelling, I think, is essential, surely, for the sciences, somehow for climate change, it's just utterly wrong. So I think the idea that he's going to come up with some sort of coherent strategy or theory is pretty forlorn, I would think.
Oh, indeed, but I guess all I'm saying is it's easy to be a sceptic. We should be sceptics. The word sceptic has been lost to us. That's a real pity. But, you know, we shouldn't just listen to sceptics. We need to actually base our decisions on something.
Brendan, you'd like to comment?
Yeah, I think it's important to realise, and I don't know Ian Pilmer at all, so I've got this is not actually a comment about him, but a lot of the climate change science scepticism has been shown to be funded by vested interests.
Yeah.
And the best and the most concrete example we have of this is last year at the AGM of the Bank of America, there was a shareholder initiative forced on the agenda by a shareholder action group, which were all the Rockefeller, the living members of the Rockefeller family, whose great-grandfather had founded the Bank of America, who were still shareholders. Of course, one of them had found out that the board had been funding to the tune of, it was a lot of money, something like $500,000 US a year, one of the major global climate change science sceptic groups. And what they did was force them to stop doing it and put the money into alternative energy, you know, research. Right? So you know, a lot of the... And I said, this is not a comment about Ian Pilmer, because I don't know him, but I actually have a colleague who was a member of this international organisation. They get their money from some very interesting sources. It's not accidental.
So what you're saying, Brendan, is we should do a bit of a background check, see where Ian's money's coming from.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying.
No, but maybe I am. Thank you. Any more comments from our panel? Suzanne?
I think I work in the same department as Ian at the university, so I'm not going to make any comment about Ian personally. I think debate in science is incredibly important and is a fundamental aspect of science, but I think that it's very easy target to try and debunk and confuse a lot of people by claiming a lack of evidence for climate change when by far the majority of scientists can see that it is happening. And despite the fact that I know that part of Ian's book is around looking at modelling and saying, well, the modelling doesn't necessarily prove anything, but what we are seeing is evidence, and what we need to make sure is that when people are looking at this subject, it is evidence-based, and we are seeing evidence of climate change. There has always been climate change, and I don't dispute that. That's one of Ian's basic premises. There has always been climate change. I don't know any climate change scientist who doesn't agree with that aspect of what Ian says, but it's the more recent issues, which we're looking at on a much finer timescale than we've ever had the capacity to do in the geological record. And those two different timescales are incredibly important in understanding the difference between geological evidence and the current evidence that we're looking at today.
Yeah. Richard.
Look, just very quickly, in terms of evidence, I mean, let's put this into perspective. In 1991, we drove interest rates up so high that we sacked 1 million people. The recession we had to have because we were afraid we might have a blowout in the current account deficit. We just spent worldwide trillions of dollars because we were worried that the banks might collapse. We live in a world of uncertainty. I can't tell you what the exchange rate will be in 3 months, and we're saying to climate scientists, if you can't tell me what the weather will be like in 70 years' time, and you better get it precise, we're not going to act because of uncertainty. It's easy to play to this need for certainty, but get over it. We're not going to find it.
Thank you. I'm moving on to another question. Upstairs, please.
I've recently spent quite a bit of time in China, and recently at a friend's apartment in Shanghai, I was running around closing all the lights off until I went out onto the balcony and noticed that most of the 22 million people in the city had their air conditioners going day and night. And then I felt a little bit small. So my question is to all of you, picking up on Richard's comments about climate awareness is about feeling guilty. How do we stop people from losing heart? How do we stop just feeling guilty but helpless?
Brendan, do you want to start with that?
Yeah. Well, I think we need a number of things to happen in parallel. I think hopelessness comes when people are fearful, and when they, hopelessness can come from a number of sources. It can come from ignorance or fear based on ignorance. So I think education about how mitigation is actually really easy and how there's lots of ways in which we can adapt. So there actually isn't, there's not a, there's all sorts of ways in which we can solve the problem faster than we're creating it and avoid perverse outcomes, and all sorts of interesting things we can do to adapt. In fact, adaptation creates economic opportunities for enterprising people. Hopelessness also comes when our political systems become dominated by people who won't show leadership. We've all seen what's happened in the USA with the election of President Obama. I don't know if you watched. I watched CNN last night. They had his his speech in Africa, in Ghana. And here we had, a man whose father was a goat herder, in Africa, coming back to talk to Africa to say that the USA wants to be their partner, So, leadership can make all the difference. I think educated people can make the difference, and showing people that there are solutions. Having said that, nothing's easy in this world.
Suzanne, can I ask you to comment?
I think the other thing that scientists need to do is to be... we're quite often, particularly in this particular arena, portrayed as the doom and gloom merchants. We're providing the evidence, the possibilities, the risk elements there. And so the idea that there's nothing that we can do is one that is very dominant, I think, in the media. And I think what we need to do is say there are the risks. We know what the evidence is. We know what the evidence is telling us. We can make some predictions about what might happen, but we also have enormous opportunities, and I think that's where Australia in particular has enormous capacity to sort of lead the world and say we can do something different, we can look at new technologies, we can be innovative, we can take risks. Of course, politicians don't like risk-taking, I think it's sort of inherently not in their genetics to enjoy risk. But I think that we've got to be much more comfortable as societies to take those risks and say that some of the things will work, some of them won't work, but be comfortable with that and not have that fear factor built in.
Thank you. Richard?
Look, I think it is hard to remain optimistic, so I work more on seething white-hot rage. But, that's not...
He took his antidepressants before the session.
But, you don't have to lose your sense of humour while you have that kind of anger. But, look, that's not something I suggest everyone need. But the last thing we need is for people to be hopeless. The last thing that we need is for people to give up. That's what our opponents want. And the reason I say guilt won't save the planet is because guilt is unsustainable. You can't ask people to feel guilty their whole lives. They won't. They'll give up. And that's what people want you to do. So I don't feel guilty. I feel angry and, at times optimistic and at times pessimistic. So I think that people should turn their lights off when they don't need to, but they should get angry at people who won't. They should buy a small car if they don't need a big car, and they should get angry at politicians that won't introduce simple fuel efficiency standards. I think if we're going to solve this problem, we need to fight it all on all fronts. And that means, yes, there's a role for individuals, but we as individuals cannot reduce BHP's emissions. We as individuals cannot reduce any large emitters' pollution. But by gee, we can vote for people who want to. But the problem is that what political parties do is put all of their effort into the minority of the population who change their votes, and they ignore people who don't change their votes. So if you're not willing to change your vote, I guarantee you the politicians won't be willing to change their mind.
I think there's an underlying message there for all of us, and that is take very good care with who you elect as your political representatives. Start electing the people that are going to stand up and be counted rather than the party. Okay, next question from downstairs, please.
Thank you. I'd like to address Barry Harrop. I'd like to address my question to the panel and for the benefit of the interstate guests here. In South Australia, we're kind of like the canary in the coal mine in terms of climate change. It's happening and we're right in it. And one only has to look at the whole Darling Basin issue there. But the question is whether or not the panel have actually looked at the 30-year plan that's been released in South Australia on water, and coincidentally the same week the 30-year plan on increasing the population by 500,000 people, when we haven't worked out when we're going to get the water from now to sustain the existing communities.
Excellent question, and I'll go to Suzanne first.
Well, interesting. I was at the launch of the 30-year plan, Water for Good, and I have read the plan. I think that, and of course then there was the plan for Greater Adelaide, as you say. The two don't seem to quite talk to each other, and that was certainly my view when I looked at the two. I don't have any idea what the solution is. I do think that the growth rates, which we're told for the whole of Australia, are good for the economy. I do think that we need to look seriously at those issues. One of the, you know, it's almost a taboo subject to talk about population growth in the planet as a whole, and certainly population growth in any particular country. It's something that you don't hear politicians talking about, particularly when you start talking about limiting it. There's a whole range of political ramifications that has, but I do think it's an incredibly important topic that we do need to not be frightened to discuss. I don't know what the solution to that is, but clearly there is a major problem. The Water for Good policy claims that it has solved our water problems for good. I couldn't see from the plan how that could be achieved.
Richard.
Look, the population question, you know, you're right, it's a vexed issue, but there's no... I have a very straightforward approach. I don't resile in any way from one simple truth, that the more people there are using a resource, the less resource we get each, on average. And, you know, Brendan made the point about averages before. Well, you know, the average number of Australian has less than 2 legs. Not much less than 2, but just less than 2. Because the number of one-legged people far exceeds the number of 3-legged people. Ergo, the average Australian... But we do not design pants for the average person. We design pants for humans, 2 legs. So on average, the more people that come into a region, the less water there is per person. What we're doing is concealing those simple truths from ourselves. I don't think there's a right number for Australia's population. But again, it's up to you. Don't blame politicians. It's up to you to say to any politician that wants to increase population, well, who's going to miss out on the scarce resources? We could use far less water each. We can use far less land each. There's no doubt that Adelaide can have a bigger population, but it can't have a bigger population and exactly the same lifestyle. There are hard choices to be made. And if those two reports don't talk to each other, that's because someone's hiding from a hard choice. And it's up to you whether you want to call them out on it.
Brendan.
Yeah, and I spoke about this yesterday. You know, our environmental impact is a product of population, how many of us there are, our affluence, our lifestyles, how much we consume, and the technology we use to do all of that, to produce and consume and live. And that's called PAT. You know, it's a Paul Ehrlich's formula from the early 1970s. Impact equals population times affluence times technology. You can come up with the same impact with different combinations of population, affluence and technology. But what that also means is you can't ignore any one. So you have to consider population. You know, it's part of the total impact. The real challenge is when you go to look at reducing your impact, there are all sorts of choices to be made about population, the size of your population, you know, its affluence, and the technologies you use. And there are winners and losers. You know, so that's why I talk about how we configure ourselves. How do we configure, you know, our societies to reduce our impact? Of course, there are these choices with all sorts of, political and economic and social and ethical considerations. But without doubt, population's part of an important part of the formula.
Thank you. Question from upstairs, please.
Yes, thank you. I was shocked to learn last week that apparently Australia has only one marine research boat which has got the task of measuring the temperatures in the deep oceans, and the temperatures they're finding are rising far faster than they ever thought. Now, how does this compare, for me as a taxpayer, where the government is now happy to buy 6 submarines, 3 warships, and all in the name of national security? So I would like to ask the panel, do you think it's time we change the whole focus on national security and the money we're giving to it, and include climate security, food security, a sustainable security for the future? How can we define national security in a climate change context, please?
What a lovely question.
I could answer it.
Go, Brendan.
Yeah, I mean, I agree absolutely. We are dealing with issue of national security, and really we're dealing with the issue of global security. Okay, so I mean, let's take this right up to the United Nations. We have a UN Security Council, right, for which global environmental security is not part of their mandate. Right, so the whole concept of security has to be redefined at a national level, or at a state, at all levels, but certainly at a national level and at a global level. And you know, if we don't have global environmental security, then we don't have any security. You know, our quest for certainty will fail for sure. So, you know, it's certainly time that we redefined the concept of security, and hence the kind of policies and measures we need for security, and you know, the funding that flows. And if we can get even a small percentage of the money that's really often thrown down the drain of defence budgets, you know, into thinking about national and global environmental security, you know, we can make some real progress.
Richard.
Look, thanks. It's a brilliant question, and defence raises all sorts of using defence as a metaphor uses all sorts of introduces possibilities, but also just rank hypocrisy. I mean, look at the invasion and the war of Iraq. There was a risk, a chance, some possibility they had weapons of mass destruction. So we made a decisive decision, a decision which I disagreed with, but it shows that as a country we are actually capable of not just spending enormous amounts of money, but literally risking people's lives because of a possibility of an adverse event. If we took that same approach to climate change, then all this nonsense that we have to put up with about why we can't act until it's certain would evaporate. Similarly, the Defence Department recently said in exchange for $60 billion worth of new toys, they would find $20 billion worth of savings. How can a public sector agency admit to having $20 billion worth of waste? With a straight face. If we spent what they admit to wasting in defence on tackling climate change, I'm not making this up, if we spent $20 billion on installing wind and solar and public transport, tomorrow, it's not rocket science, literally, defence is rocket science, this is old-fashioned stuff. All right? So, yeah, there is no better way to highlight both the inconsistency in our decision-making framework in terms of risk and our outrageous misprioritisation of resources than to compare our investment in protecting ourselves from the minute risk of invasion from Indonesia versus our complete lack of investment in protecting ourselves from very likely climate change.
Suzanne.
Well, I agree with everything that's been said. I would also like to say, however, that, of course, defence is born out of aggression, essentially, whereas I think climate change is, and particularly the science of climate change, has to take place in the spirit of collaboration. So the two in a certain sense, are mutually exclusive. Having said that, I think there is a lot of gains to be made by looking at the way the defence research funding works and applying that more broadly across the board. To a certain extent, one can come to the defence of the defence industries because they do fund an enormous amount of blue skies research. And sometimes that's for altruistic reasons on the part from the viewpoint of the defence industry because they can see a defence outcome. But very often, I have to say, I don't think that's the case. I do think that they fund, not necessarily in Australia, but certainly in other countries, they do fund blue skies research because there might be some kind of greater good outcome. But I do think that there is a fundamental disjuncture between our funding of defence and our funding of, in fact, all other sciences, with perhaps the exception of health.
Thank you, Suzanne. Just looking at the time, we'll be able to take the four questions that are standing downstairs. If anybody wants to add themselves, like one other person upstairs, we'll be able to take that, but then I'm probably going to have to cut it off at that point. I think it's time for a downstairs question, please.
Thank you. I'm surprised no one's talked about methane in this talk about beyond the city limits. My understanding is that methane's a much more strongly acting greenhouse gas, but the levels fall much faster than CO2. Therefore, there are big gains to be made. The unfortunate, uncomfortable truth is that methane equates to hamburgers and beef steak. Could the panel please comment?
Richard, go.
Brendan
first.
In terms of the what's called the global warming potential of greenhouse gases, you know, a given unit of methane is more powerful than a given the same amount of CO2. But there's vastly more of the greenhouse gases we're putting up. You know, the dominant one is carbon dioxide. Actually, the most important greenhouse gas in the atmosphere is water vapor. Right? And you know, we measure carbon dioxide and methane parts per million. Parts per million. These are they're called trace gases for that reason. So, you know, methane is a potent greenhouse gas, but we're only causing, you know, relatively small amounts of it to be emitted. So, you know, the main game really is on controlling emissions of carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuel, in my opinion.
So you're essentially saying, get it in perspective.
Yeah, it can't be ignored. It's part of the menu of mitigation responses that we have to deal with, but you know, let's not lose sight of where the majority of our effort needs to lie.
Mm. Richard,
I agree with that, but I think methane, because of its stronger global warming potential, and because it doesn't last as long in the atmosphere, there are some cheap, quick savings to be made. So if you are worried about peaking by 2020, I think methane deserves a bit more attention. But I guess the main thing that I would say about methane is that we, as a society, now take for granted that there's public debate and commentary around the right kind of car to buy or better kind of car to buy and a better kind of appliance to buy, and we don't yet have that conversation about food. So I'm certainly not an advocate for widespread vegetarianism. I don't eat meat myself, but I don't call myself a vegetarian. I think that if we want to export a very meat-intensive diet to the rest of the world, speaking of menus, you know, most countries don't eat nearly as much meat per capita as we do, and they're catching up. So I think that methane does have an important role to play, not just at a policy level, but a behavioural level. I think the next logical step for consumers who are worrying about their emissions from their own activities is to begin to look at food. And you don't... when we say to people, try not to drive your car as much, we don't say never drive your car again. I don't think we need to say to people never eat meat again, but understand there are more and less greenhouse intensive ways of eating.
Suzanne.
Well, I think somebody was talking about, you know, feeling guilty earlier. I think you know, vegetarians, you know, maybe that's the positive thing. You can feel incredibly smug. you know, I don't eat meat. It's a choice that I make, but my daughter does eat meat. And so I think that it is about balance, and it is about making choices. And I think you're absolutely right, Richard, that we need to consider what we do as individuals. And we can make those choices. We can choose to eat less meat. And that will have an impact on methane. I think the thing we've got to get an understanding of, because CO2 is you know, it's about the carbon pollution reduction scheme. It's about CO2 levels in the atmosphere. And as you said, it's actually a much more holistic mechanism that is working. And we don't actually necessarily understand how all those different components of the atmosphere do work. I mean, water vapor in the atmosphere is a greenhouse gas, but it can also act it can also increase the albedo effect of reflecting energy from the sun because of additional cloud cover. So it's an incredibly complex physical sort of system that we're dealing with. But I do think you have to take account of each of those areas and not get completely 100% focused on CO2.
I think our research and development sector is key in the issues around methane, our research and development into what we feed our animals, and maybe some changes there in addressing that. We'd certainly like to see governments, instead of cutting funds to research and development, putting more money towards research and development. Now, I think it's time for a question upstairs, please.
Okay, this question is addressed to the panel. Over the last few years, we've seen far more frequent and very much more intense bushfires, and it looks like developing into a much more of a sustainable pattern in that direction. I wonder, and this looks like developing into a very, very dangerous negative feedback mechanism. It must be pouring millions of tons of carbon into the atmosphere every year. To what extent are bushfires being factored into the kind of models that people are working on at the moment?
Yeah, yes, this whole issue of fires, very important and kind of tricky in many ways. First of all, there's been a massive increase, or the main cause of the massive increase of fires in Australia over the last 30 years is due to human activity, okay? Because the sources of ignition, massive increase in the number of sources ignition sources from human activity. That's the main reason why we've had more fires. Southeast Australia and Victoria in particular, you know, the mega fires, if I can call them that, that we've had in our forests, are driven by extreme weather conditions, extreme fire weather. Once you get a prolonged dry period, half a dozen days of 45 degree plus temperatures, 100 kilometre hour winds, okay, and then you've got ignition, nothing else matters. These things are driven by extreme fire weather. It looks like, kind of, again, this is a statistic, we've had about 3 1-200 year fire weather days in the last decade. Okay, Southeast Australia, which coincide with the big three fire events we've had. Now, is that you know, climate change? Right? Does that signify we've shifted? Because one of the, you know, the predictions of climate change is not just a change in mean, but a change in the frequency of extreme events. And we've now had 3 extreme fire events in the last 10 years. Is that the result of climate change? Well, we don't know. We'll only know retrospectively, because climate is not a weather event, it's the average weather over a period of time. So in 10 years' time, I'll be able to tell you if we've moved. But it seems very, you know, it's very strong evidence that that's the case. So it is consistent with the CSIRO climate change model predictions that there are parts of Australia that have a long-term drying trend that's going to continue, and that we're going to have more extreme weather conditions, which will, you know, which is the main driver of these kind of mega fires. So that's the kind of science of it, as I understand it. In terms of the impact on emissions, it's interesting. It will vary from landscape to landscape and ecosystem type to ecosystem type. Eucalypt forests are actually quite resilient to fire because most of the carbon in eucalypt forests is in the woody stems and roots of big old trees, and that's not combusted in a fire. Fire's burned through, and it burns the litter and the bushes and the leaves, and most of the carbon is there, and then the trees, the plants regrow, the forest starts to grow again. So our eucalypt forests in terms of carbon, are remarkably resistant. Other ecosystems are much more fragile. Alpine meadows are very fragile, for example. So, I give lectures on this, which is why I'm giving such a long answer. But
Wouldn't have guessed that.
In summary, just to give the panel a chance to answer as well, it looks like it looks like we are entering a different climatic set of conditions, so that fire regimes are going to change in different regions in Australia. The impact will depend upon the ecosystem type and what humans are doing on the land.
Thank you. Do either of the other panel want to speak?
I'd just add that I find, I'm not a scientist, but people ask me about this all the time, and the most useful concept that I've come across in terms of this is the idea of climate-enhanced events. Because people want to ask you, was this bushfire caused by climate change? And, the cause is someone lighting it, usually. There's certainly no doubt that there's good evidence that climate change appears to be enhancing how bad these bushfires are. So we need to separate the cause of the fire from how bad the fire can be, and there appears to be little doubt that the more frequent these extreme weather events, then the worse the bushfires will be. But that's different to cause.
I think as well, just a final point, that there are a lot of issues around land management that we need to contemplate when we're talking about bushfires in particular. And I think that land management practices may well have to adapt to adapting changes and the adapting risk of fires, big fires happening.
Okay, thank you. I have two more questions. We have three more minutes. Obviously, I'm going to run a little bit over time, but not very much. The lady in downstairs, please.
I'm troubled about international transport, in particular taking ore from Australia, cutting it over to China to be smelted there. And I would suggest that if we could have mining companies putting in 10% smelting their own close to the site and putting in 10% more green energy every year, that this might help in that respect. But there's a lot of international transport going on that must be using an awful lot of carbon. Would you like to comment?
I'll ask the panel to streamline their answers. Richard, do you want to go first?
Sure. Look, it's much worse than that. There's a company in Scotland, I think, that catches fresh seafood, flies it to Asia, has it peeled, flies it back, sells fresh peeled local seafood. there's no... True story. There's no doubt that the way we've designed our structures ignores greenhouse. And once we get decent carbon pricing in, and by decent I mean high enough to change behaviour, companies won't behave like that. But it's not all bad. And people think we'll never be able to have an international holiday. Well, the three-day trip to Vanuatu is in real trouble, but maybe if we go to Europe, we'll actually spend 6 or 8 weeks there once in our life, have a great time and come home. So, things need to change a lot. There'll still be transport, but we need to think about it differently.
Brendan?
Yeah, it's a good observation you've made, important observation. If you look in Australia, the example I like to use is, why did we make steel in Newcastle? Of course, the ore wasn't in Newcastle. Right? Where's the ore now? Well, it's up in the Kimberleys. But the coal was in Newcastle, and that's where the energy was. So you're absolutely right. There's no reason we couldn't make the steel in the Kimberleys. And that evokes a whole other set of issues, I know, but just dealing with the carbon emissions. Because it is possible to power these industrial processes using alternative energy sources now. Right? So... again, we can reconfigure even how we do something as energy-intensive steelmaking in a way that dramatically cuts its carbon footprint.
Suzanne, just quickly.
I think globally we also need to consider about the materials that we use, the assumption that iron is what needs to be used for major construction. Therefore, that's why we export huge quantities to China, for example, because they are using huge quantities and they don't have the capacity to deliver that currently in China itself. I don't think that we're looking... It's an economic question, and it does come down to the fact that it will cost more to do as the person posing the question suggested and not have this international travel. And it will come down to a tax. It will come down to a carbon tax on those companies.
Thank you. And our lucky last question.
Well, thanks to the previous questioner, because you've already touched on, in part, an answer to my question, which is, in broad brush, how do we get environmentally sustainable export policies? And I also want to say thanks to the panel because, and the chair, because I feel a lot more comfortable now than I did when I arrived about the whole issue of climate change. Just to see, I mean, I'm familiar, you know, with a whole lot of people working in this area, but it's just fantastic to have had
this. We were discussion. Paid by the mining company.
So,
where's my check?
Now, I haven't.
You got a check?
I've got.
Okay, the question.
No. I've just got to qualify the question as follows. I'm interested, and perhaps it's also to our honourable chair from SAF, to hear how you may see organic growing, holistic organic principles, as a paradigm for changing agricultural practices, hopefully in a non-divisive way, as a paradigm for changing agricultural practices and also in helping develop this environmentally sustainable export policy that it seems to me would be a good thing to go for as growers. I speak as a former farmer who farmed both conventionally and organically.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for offering me the opportunity to answer a question, but I'm actually going to decline and hand it to our panel because it's the last time that you will hear from them this morning, and very quickly they're going to answer. Very quickly. You get that, don't you? Suzanne?
I think it comes down to economics. Again, I think that a lot of people would buy and consume organic produce if it was the same price as inorganic produce. And certainly in the UK, that's been found to be the case, where organic costs are coming way down and people are buying it more frequently because it is a choice that they would like to make, but it comes down to an economic choice. And if there is a carbon tax on less sustainable practices, then it makes that price difference much less.
Richard?
Yes, and more, well, to add to that, with climate change and dwindling energy supplies, the price of fuel is getting higher, the price of fertilizer is getting higher, the price of transport is getting higher. Organic food is more expensive, but interestingly, its competitor is getting dearer and dearer by the day. So in order to keep it brief, if you log on to the Australia Institute website, give me your email address. I'll give you long answers to everything on a 3-week
Yeah, okay. Well, this is turning into a long answer. Thank you. Brendan?
I don't think I have anything concrete to add other than just to, you know, observe that talking about food, I think, is really good way to come at the climate change problem, because it's something we all need. It's central to our lives. And it just shows you how connected climate change issue is to everything that we do.
Mm. Okay.
It's a good way to end.
I'd like to thank you for being an absolutely fabulous audience. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your commitment to the Festival of Ideas. Thank you for your questions. I think probably the one key thing for me that's come out of this morning is to hear that it's not just the South Australian Farmers Federation that has very grave concerns about the federal government's blind commitment to forwarding cap and trade as we have it at the moment, as they're certainly trying to continue with. On behalf of
the Festival of Ideas on behalf of the City of Adelaide and the State of South Australia, would you take the opportunity to thank our fantastic panellists, Suzanne Miller, Richard Dennis and Brendan Mackey. See you next year.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.